Good afternoon again. I'm trying to get into the slides. Must be somewhere here. I indulged in the temptation to prepare a PowerPoint presentation, and I fell into the typical mistake one does in this case. I prepared 40 slides, which you have in your materials. But of course, I'm perfectly aware that to go through 40 slides at this time of the day and under such weather condition would be would amount to sort of torture, or at least inhuman treatment. So I tried to figure out how to get out from this embarrassing situation, and I opted for two rather unconventional solution. The first one, sorry, I'm trying to to get into the talking I don't find the slideshow. Slideshow. Yeah, it's there. Sorry. On one side, I highlighted in red the most important parts that I will go through you through the presentation. So this makes things a little bit more not really funny like Simon's presentation, but at least colorful and in particular not so long. And the second measure was to begin with the conclusions. Of course, you are allowed to leave after the conclusions if you wish. But the conclusion also can perhaps help to focus on what are the main point of the presentation, and I think will make things clearer. The first point of the conclusion is that, as it was already mentioned today by other speakers, U.S. judgments do not always fare very well abroad because of many reasons, in particular the many particularities and many particular features of U.S. Procedural law that have been gone through today by many speakers. And this also concerns, of course, Europe as such. There are many very interesting articles written by Sam Baumgarten on that, so I'm actually presenting most of the results of Sam Baumgarten's articles today. However, on certain issues, as was clear in many presentations today, US and Europe, at least with respect to procedure, are coming closer. This is true with respect to personal jurisdiction. This is true with respect to class action, as Eva has explained. It is true also to a certain extent with respect to punitive damages. I will tell you why. So this might facilitate in the future the recognition of US judgment in Europe to a certain extent. However, there are serious obstacles that are still in place. And I must say, you know that the Hague Judgment Project is well underway again in The Hague. There is a 2017 draft that has been elaborated last February, and there is a new meeting of the Special Commission, which is scheduled for next November, if I'm not wrong. I must say, however, that I'm rather skeptical, not on the project itself. I think there are perhaps good chances to get to an end this time, but I'm rather skeptical, perhaps I'm too optimistic, but in any case, I'm rather skeptical about the effects, because I have the impression that looking into this draft, that the Hague project, the Hague future Hague Convention, will not bring about some spectacular changes. As we will see, the main obstacles to recognition of U.S. judgment in Europe relates either to jurisdiction, and to a certain extent, some of the problems are already solved by the developments we have seen today. To another extent, there are specific provisions in the Hague draft, but they are drafted in a quite prudent way, in a quite cautious way, and I think that they might not be so helpful to really enlarge the recognition of U.S. judgment in Europe. And on the other side, many other problems relate more to public policy. And of course, in an international convention, you cannot really have an impact on how public policy is applied in different member states. So you are allowed to leave now, as I mentioned. But if you don't, some preliminary remarks. It was mentioned already by Christoph some minutes ago, you are all aware, of course, that the Brussels Regulation and Lugano Convention do not apply in this context. So we have to rely basically on national rules on recognition of the single individual European states. And of course, these rules are quite different one from the other. There is much less uniformity than there is among the different sister states in the United States. Another preliminary remark is that some of the obstacles to recognition of foreign judgments are not specific to US judgments. There are, for instance, in a certain number of European states, a basic principle of non-recognition of foreign judgments, some Scandinavian states, for instance. Or in some other states, there is a strict reciprocity requirement, which is interpreted in a rather formal way. So it's a treaty-based reciprocity. And if you don't have a treaty, you don't have recognition. Of course, there are several exceptions to this. But this kind of problem, of course, affects all foreign judgments and not particularly US judgments. But they are, nevertheless, obstacles to recognition. In other countries, which are in principle much more open to recognition, in theory at least, you might find some specific obstacles which are related to special privileges that are granted either to citizens of those states or to persons who are domiciled in those states. You know that the famous or infamous privilège de juridiction, which was applied in France traditionally based on the civil code, was in fact dropped by the Cour de Cassation in the Prieur case in 2006. So there is now no more restriction in that respect in France. But you might find this kind of restriction in other countries, particularly Eastern European countries. And you find a similar restriction in Switzerland, which is, in theory, very open on the recognition of foreign judgment. But in reality, if you look closer to the Swiss Private International Law Act, you have Article 149, which creates a very strong privilege for people who are domiciled in Switzerland, so that foreign judgment in the area of contract or torts are, in principle, not recognizable in Switzerland. Of course, there are a certain number of restrictions, of exceptions, when the defendant was domiciled in Switzerland. Exception that can be based when, for instance, the jurisdiction of the foreign court was based on a choice of court agreement or on voluntary submission. But in the other situation, it's very difficult to get a recognition. Of course, with respect to this kind of situation, a Hague Convention, if successful and if ratified by this country, could be certainly very effective. I won't go through other technical difficulties which might arise in the recognition of U.S. judgment due to differences in procedure. For instance, the meaning of the document that instituted proceedings, which might be difficult to determine with respect to foreign judgment. It might be difficult also to assess the finality of the judgment, which is normally a condition for recognition. So, but I won't spend much time on this. And I won't also spend much time on a series of features of U.S. Procedural law, which are generally recognized as not being obstacles to recognition. The fact that there is a jury trial in itself does not preclude recognition in general. The American rules of cost or contingency fee agreements also normally do not preclude recognition of the judgment. And also the possible extraterritorial application of U.S. law, subject, of course, to public policy consideration, which might, material public policy consideration that might become relevant in certain situations. So, to get down to the nitty-gritty, to the real problematic issues, the problems with U.S. judgments are traditionally with respect to jurisdiction. There are problems related to public policy, as I mentioned before, for different reasons. Some are related to sovereignty considerations that are linked to the role of judicial assistance, as it is interpreted in certain European countries, service of process and taking of evidence. In particular, of course, there are problems with punitive damages awards and perhaps with certain aspects of class actions. So I will go through these issues in the fastest way is possible to do it. I guarantee. Jurisdictional issue, well, of course, the approach in all countries that allow recognition of foreign judgment, the jurisdiction of the foreign court, of the court of origin, is always a condition for recognition. The way it is actually applied is very different from one country to the other, and I don't want to go into these differences. It's not the purpose of the conference. But be aware that, of course, you have to look into the specific characteristics of each national recognition rules. But if we look in a more general way, we can easily see that the biggest problem with respect to U.S. judgment was, of course, doing business jurisdiction. And doing business jurisdiction was always considered as exorbitant in most European countries. And through the Goodyear and Daimler decision, of course, this problem is in principle solved. There won't be any problem anymore. With other situation of general jurisdiction, of course, we might still have problem because the United States still applies the famous transient or tag jurisdiction, which was also considered as compatible with the due process standard in the famous Burnham case. But this is quite limited. It doesn't apply to corporation also, and it's not a normal situation. Even the United States is not so common to have a jurisdiction based simply on service of process on to a present person. So I don't think this is a real crucial issue with respect to Europe. But if you have a judgment which is based only on that jurisdictional ground, certainly there will be problem to recognize it in Europe. In the area of specific jurisdiction, I think probably there aren't very serious problems with respect to torts, although by seeing some of the speakers today, listening to some of the speakers today, I might ask, because of course if you begin to create jurisdiction based on the use of US dollars or of the payment which is transiting in the US, of course that might be very problematic. But if you look at traditional areas as product liability, for instance, well, the McIntyre case, as Sam has explained this morning, the approach of the U.S. courts and the Supreme Court is extremely limited, and in fact the scope of jurisdiction is much more restricted than in Europe, where we found jurisdiction based on the place of the event. So most of these decisions will probably do not have problem in being recognized in Europe. The same is true with respect to internet tort claims, because due to the purposeful availment requirement, which is the basis for jurisdiction, for specific jurisdiction in the US, normally US courts do not accept to base their jurisdictional reach simply on the simple accessibility of a website, but require normally a sort of targeting of the forum state, some other elements. And so in that respect, also, they are a little more restrictive than the approach which is often followed in Europe, followed by the ECJ itself in a series of cases where accessibility of the website was considered as itself in many situations a sufficient connection to create a jurisdiction. There are still some problems, and in that respect, I respectfully disagree with Linda, if I'm allowed to. In the area of contracts, she said this morning that the specific jurisdiction in the U.S. is clearly more restrictive than in Europe, but probably in torts. Well, in torts, of course, we agree. In the area of contracts, it's different, because in the area of contracts, of course, you know that European states normally base jurisdiction on the place of performance. This is true under the European instrument, but also true under many national system of recognition. And in the US, you, of course, under the minimum contact test and the transacting business approach, you might have a full other series of contacts that might be relevant, reaching out in order for the conclusion of the contract, the negotiation, the place of business meetings, the place of payments, and many others. And of course, in that respect, the extension, the reach of US court jurisdiction can be much wider. And in those cases, you will have probably in Europe a problem, at least in certain countries, a problem of recognition. And as mentioned, I don't think that the Hague Judgment Project, as it looks like now, will be able to solve that, because if you look into at least in the 2016 and 2017 draft that are available on the website of the Hague Conference, you will see that in contractual matters, the solution which is proposed does not go much farther the solution that are actually used in many European countries. Second category of problem, role of judicial assistance. In this respect, as is well known, there is a basic disagreement in principle between European states and the US on the role of services, service of process, and of taking of evidence abroad. In Europe, this is regarded as a judicial task, and so it is a matter of state sovereignty. A transnational service of process, transnational taking of evidence is a matter of sovereignty. In the US, on the contrary, it is something that is more functional. It is left to the parties and their attorneys. And of course, they are subject to certain restriction, important limitation, based on due process in particular, and the Mullen decision and many others. But you don't have a problem of sovereignty there. And the corollary of this is, of course, with respect to the role of the international instrument, Hague Conventions, European tend to insist on a mandatory and exclusive application of the Hague Service Convention, of the Hague Evidence Convention, whereas in the US there is a wide trend to allow a concurrent use of a national law mechanism. And of course, this can lead to some problems in recognition, in particular in three areas: service by mail, service to a US subsidiary of an European company, and of course, pre-trial discovery. Very quickly on service by mail, it's certainly possible under US law, although transnational service by mail is subject also in the US to many limitations. You have to respect international convention, you have to respect also the position of the state where the defendant or the addressee of the notification of the notice is domiciled. But it happens, we see also from the practice, that it happens that service by mail is actually used. And this might result in problem because, at least in certain European countries, the tendency is to refuse service by international mail, particularly in those countries that have raised the reservation against Article 10 of the Hague Service Convention. Among them, Switzerland, Germany, and many other countries, in particular Eastern European countries, but not only. This can result in a denial of recognition because the national recognition rules in this country focus on regular service and not simply on an effective notice in many cases, or based on public policy because this is regarded as a sovereignty issue. The Swiss Federal Tribunal has taken and recently reaffirmed a very strict stance on that issue in at least two judgments of 2016, saying that we are not prepared to recognize a judgment if service was done by mail. I must say I'm rather skeptical on this approach. I'm rather critical on this approach. I think it's a rearguard action that is fight here a little bit. There are many European countries that allow, in fact, service by mail. So many countries have not raised a reservation against Article 10 of the Hague Service Convention. And it's very important, the European service regulation, of course, among European states only, allows service by mail. And of course, this is of course a new trend that should be taken into account. Moreover, as you certainly know, the Brussels Regulation and the Lugano Convention have a more relaxed approach to service of process. They do not require regular service, but they are satisfied with effective service, effective notice, and this might have, at least in certain countries, a certain effect, a certain overlap on national recognition rules. So I think this is a problem that probably as a trend might be solved in the next year. I hope so. There are some problems with respect to service to a US subsidiary regarded as an agent of the foreign corporation. This way of services was allowed by the US Supreme Court in the very famous Volkswagen versus Schlank case, where the US Supreme Court considered that in this case you don't have to apply the Hague Convention because we are not in a case of service abroad, but just domestic service. And of course, this opinion, this interpretation is not shared by all European state, and this might lead to problem of recognition or regular service again. And of course, you have a problem with respect to discovery, because in the US perspective, as you know, of course, discovery is essential, also for guarantee equal footing, equal treatment to both parties of the proceedings. And if one of the parties in Europe and discovery is not allowed, of course, this creates some problems, some imbalance. And this was one of the reasons why the US Supreme Court probably interpreted the Hague Evidence Convention, the very famous case Aerospatial, already in 1988, as being not exclusive but just optional for the purpose of international discovery, which allows US court and US plaintiffs to as parties to have recourse to national domestic system, in particular the federal rules of civil procedure. This may have perhaps a certain impact on recognition. I think in Europe, even in more restrictive countries, like Germany has normally is very sensitive on this kind of issue, the Bundesgerichtshof has recognized that discovery per se is not incompatible with public policy, of course. But there might be problems when the foreign judgment was based on evidence situated, located in the requested European state, and the evidence was gathered through channels that are not allowed by the Hague Convention, so in violation of the Hague Convention, because of this sovereignty problem approach. There might be problems when the evidence, when the judgment is based on evidence gathered through fishing expedition, so pre-litigation discovery, not pre-trial, but pre-litigation discovery, which was not linked to actual pending proceedings. And this might also be problematic. And to, according to a view, I'm not completely convinced by that view, but some commentators consider that there might be even problem with data protection regulation, with European data protection regulation. So in this situation, discovery might be a problem for recognition. Third big issue, of course, punitive damages. In respect to these, of course, you are all aware that the traditional view is incompatibility with public policy of the European states. There's a very famous German decision of the Bundesgerichtshof in 1992. Other Supreme Courts have followed the same approach. I won't recall here what are the main reasons for this, but you find them there. In Switzerland, the approach has always been more flexible. We don't have a Supreme Court, we don't have a federal court decision. The highest decision was a decision by an old decision by a Basel Court of Appeal of 1989, which took a rather positive approach, not incompatibility, not in principle incompatibility with the Swiss public policy, and the judgment was even recognized in the specific case. Of course, it was a limited amount of punitive damages. So the same approach, I think, it's making its way now in many other European countries. Due to a convergence, the word convergence has been used also in other contexts, is a convergence with respect to the approach to punitive damages to a certain extent between the US and Europe. Of course, it's an initial process, I would say. We are not still there, but there is a certain tendency to come closer. The US Supreme Court, as I mentioned this morning, has rendered very important decision in order to reduce and to curb excessive punitive damages awards. And in Europe, there has been, and there still has, still be, there still is, ongoing discussion on the possibility of introducing some kind of punitive damages. There was a long discussion at European level, which didn't end up with the admission of punitive damages, but at least the issue was very, very deeply discussed. And in some member states, you have the same discussion. For instance, in France, I've seen that there is a recent project after the old Catala project, there is a recent draft on civil liability, which provides for a sort of civil, amende civile, which is something a little bit similar to punitive damages, even with a lot of differences. And this tendency has also is also expressed by some European texts, in particular Recital 32 of the Rome II Regulation. Of course, we are in a completely different context because it's choice of law, it's not a recognition of judgment, but the recital takes a not-so-negative stance with respect to punitive damages. Only punitive damages of an excessive nature can be regarded in the specific circumstances as contrary to public policy. Although these developments have led to a wave now, I would say, of Supreme Court decision in different member states. In Spain, 2001, in France, 2010. Now there is an ordinanza of the Corte di Cassazione of 2016. The case is not ended yet because the question will go to the Sezioni Unite, which is the reunited chambers of the Corte di Cassazione. But all these decisions for the moment go in the same direction, which is no a priori incompatibility with public policy, but refusal of excessive awards. Of course, this doesn't mean that U.S. judgment will be very often be recognized, but at least there is a move in that direction. No a priori incompatibility for many reasons. Of course, a restrictive understanding of public policy, but also the awareness that in civil law countries there are also some kinds of civil penalties or civil punishment course, quite different for the moment from punitive damages. And also, for instance, in the recent Italian decision, a very strong awareness, a very strong position on the fact that tort law does not necessarily have only a purely compensatory function, but can also have some punitive or at least dissuasive function. And this is an opening with respect to the punitive damages idea. Of course, we still have the problem of the amount, which should be evaluated based on a sort of proportionality test. We find this idea in all these decisions that I mentioned. On what should this proportionality be based? But all these decisions refer to the damage, to the seriousness of the damage. All these decisions refer to the reprehensibility of conduct. This is quite similar to the famous Gore test in the US. But of course, we also have to be realistic. One of the standards, one of the paradigms, will also be the amount of damages that could have been awarded in the forum of the requested state in a similar situation, which means that many U.S. awards will still be rejected under this heading. And this was the case, for instance, in the French case I mentioned before. Of course, even in this situation, partial recognition is always possible. So you may recognize the part of the award which concerns compensatory damages, including also pain and suffering, including the legal costs, if the judgment directly awards legal costs to one of the parties. What is not yet be done is to recognize a clear possibility to mitigate the amount of the award. Because this it's a little bit difficult under the perspective which is traditional in Europe and also in the United States of a prohibition of a review on the merit of the decision. But I think that a mitigation should be possible in principle. I think I'm running out of my time. So just very briefly on class actions. I think that it's quite clear in all member states that class actions are not per se incompatible with public policy. Of course, this point is even clearer after the novelties which have been so clearly and so completely presented by Eva this morning. The movement goes in the same direction, even more than for punitive damages, a real convergence here. The only big problem which is still there is, and the main obstacle, is should we recognize a binding effect to a class action decision or a class action settlement for absent class members, because we have the problem of their right to be heard and their freedom to present, to decide whether to bring or not to bring the claim. And the problem in particular arises, I would say, for those class members who did receive a proper notice of the class action, but they did not opt in, because they have also in the United States the possibility of participating in the procedure. But what if they don't? They don't participate, and in particular, if you have European members of the class that have received a notice but remained passive. What should we do in this case? I think there are two main opinions, of course, very divided still on this point. The first opinion is, no, we need an opt-in, so we can recognize only if there is an opt-in by these members. And the other opinion, which is more flexible, is no, we can also recognize if, and provided that there was really a proper notice, and provided, of course, that in the foreign proceedings, certain fairness was guaranteed, in particular through adequate representation of the absent class members. And this was the position taken by a very recent decision that you probably have all seen on conflict of laws net by a Belgian Court of Appeal in March this year. But of course, this is also facilitated because, as Eva explained this morning, Belgium is one of those countries that have an opt-out proceedings or something similar. So of course, the problem which be much more serious for those countries that still did not introduce the opt-out mechanism. So you know already know my conclusion, and thank you for being here, even if you had the conclusion at the beginning.